Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with three lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Welcome back to Hardline here on News Radio 930 WBEN. Joe Beamer with you. We're about 2 hours from kickoff, and hopefully you're spending it with us, getting a little political information before you get into game day mode. Now, last hour we had the Democrat hour, and this hour, the Republican hour, starting with Carl Calabrese. Carl, good morning.
Good morning, Joe.
Carl, let me ask you what I asked our last two guests. What did you take away from the local elections on Tuesday?
Oh, there were a number of things that were major takeaways, all equally interesting, I think. First of all, it's obvious that Byron Brown just pulled off a political masterpiece with winning a write-in vote. I mean, everyone thought that was going to be a really steep hill to climb, and it was, but they did it very, very smartly. They had a great strategy, and they implemented the strategy almost flawlessly in terms of educating the public on how to do a write-in. And as I said on a few shows, what the Brown campaign was asking voters to do was not particularly difficult, but it was different. And that's always a challenge, is getting people to do something different. But they did it. He got his organization up and running and humming again, which a lot of people know that if that had happened in June, that primary would have been won, and we never would have had an election for mayor in November. But he did it, overcame a lot of odds, overcame a lot of internal pressure from the Democrat Party and its elected officials to get out. If you recall, there were quite a few very prominent Democrats who very harshly, after the primary, basically said, Byron, man up. You lost. Accepted the verdict of the people and move on. He didn't do that. He stuck in there. He showed an internal fortitude that he has. Many people wondered if he had that internal fortitude, that fire going. He did, and he won. And the other takeaway, however, is, and this just caught my attention, the fact that an avowed, self-avowed socialist and member of the Democratic Socialists of America got 41% of the vote in Buffalo. I was at a talk that Bob McCarthy, the political writer for the Buffalo News, gave the night before election. And he made a very interesting point. He said, you know, Buffalo has always been known as kind of a moderate, conservative, ethnic Democrat bastion. And he said, but something happened in the last few years. The first time since 1950, the population of Buffalo has increased. It's increased for two reasons: young people moving back into Buffalo and immigration. And he said, the question is, where do these people land politically? Do they fall into the traditional mode of a more conservative, ethnic Democrat town, or are they going to associate with something farther to the left, like the Democratic Socialists of America? And he said, this election is not only going to tell us who the next mayor is, it's going to tell us what the future soul of Buffalo looks like. And I'll tell you, 41%, if you would have told me a couple of years ago that I'm a self-avowed socialist, member of the Democratic Socialists of America, could get 41% in Buffalo, I would have said, it was like, you're probably smoking the devil's asparagus, because that's not going to happen in Buffalo. It did. It is a temporary defeat for the Democratic Socialists of America, but it's also a beachhead. And it's a beachhead I think you're going to see them come back to and attempt to make even further gains. As I said, it was in the paper this morning. If I were head of the Democratic Socialists of New York, I would not be putting an out-of-business sign at my party headquarters. I think they're going to come back. And they're going to come back and use that 41%. So those are a couple of the major takeaways. And, you know, like everything in politics, it's evolving, and it will continue to evolve and change. And we'll see to see where the forces land in the next election.
Now, on the Republican side of things, we have John Garcia, who is leading right now, very close sheriff's race, and we had Lynn Dixon defeated by Kevin Hardwick. What do you take away from those two elections?
In both cases, I believe if there had not been a marquee race for mayor in the city of Buffalo, if it had ended in June, we would not be waiting on absentee and military ballots for Garcia. He would have won very comfortably, and I believe that if Lynn Dixon wasn't elected on election night, we would be waiting on absentee and military ballots in a very close race. You know, both campaigns were faced with a lot of obstacles. Number one, there's 138,000 more Democrats than Republicans. That's a huge obstacle. Number two, you had this marquee race for mayor, which did bring out probably 15,000 to 20,000 more votes than would have occurred had the race not been on the ballot. And being Buffalo, a lot of those Democrat voters come out and vote for mayor, and then they stay on the Democrat line for the down ballot race. And in Garcia's case, he had two other minor party candidates, which in total took, I think, the last I saw when I went to bed that night, was almost 21,000 votes. I think it's even higher now. 80 to 85% of those votes would have gone to him. And so he ran a masterful campaign to overcome those three obstacles, any one of which could have killed his efforts. He had no margin for error and ran just a great strategy and tactics to he's going to win that race. He's got a comfortable lead, and as we know, that absentee ballots tend to track what happened at the polling place on election night very closely. She would have to win 75-80% of those absentees, and that's a tall order. So those are the takeaways on the Republican side. But, you know, Lynn Dixon, Lynn is a good, excellent candidate. She's run twice now for countywide office, and both times she got 47%. You know, if I'm the Republican leadership, I want to take a look at both of those races, and I'd want to drill down into the numbers to ask the question, okay, what do we have to do in the future to get Lynn Dixon from 47% to 50% plus one? There's got to be clues in those numbers that a better run campaign aimed at getting from 47 to 51 in the areas most likely to produce those extra votes could be geared to and could deliver her on election night. So those are some of the Republican takeaways that I had.
You know, looking at other candidates, and this is a question I wanted to ask you on election night, so I'm glad I get to ask you today. We look in Amherst, and you had Brian Culpa running against someone who hadn't been in Amherst for 20 years. Do you think that the Republican Party of your county or the Republican Party of Amherst could have run a better candidate in what used to be a Republican stronghold?
Well, assuming they could find a better candidate, and, you know, it's a lot easier to find A and A-plus list candidates when you have a strong organization and you've been winning races. Usually you have a surplus of them coming to you saying, I'd like to be your candidate. But when you have lost a lot of races, the town went completely Democrat in the last couple of cycles, you've been losing on a consistent basis, you're having trouble raising money because of that, it's oftentimes tough to find A and A-plus list candidates. It's just the nature of things. You know, winning attracts a lot of people, a lot of money, a lot of good candidates. When that's not happening, you're struggling as a party. And I think you're seeing that in a lot of towns in Erie County that, you know, once were Republican, strong Republican, now have turned either marginal or Democrat. It's tough to overcome that. And I think that's the situation Amherst found itself in.
Were you surprised in Amherst to see Brian Culpa on the conservative line as well as the Democrat line?
Not really. No. I mean, there have been lots of Democrats the last 5 years, 10 years that have gotten the conservative endorsement. And I think he appeals to a lot of the conservative principles and made a case for himself that he's a certainly a moderate. You know, he may not be the most conservative, but he's certainly a moderate candidate. And you know, that's how he's run his town. And so I was not surprised to see him get that conservative endorsement.
What did you take away in Virginia, where former Governor Terry McAuliffe won his or lost against Glenn Youngkin, who ran a campaign, you know, based on, you know, education and COVID mandates? What did you take away from that victory? And what do you see that for the future in 2022?
There's so much to take away from that race, Joe. The first thing is, you know, Terry McAuliffe tried to make the race about Donald Trump, and that didn't work. And so I think that that's going to be put to bed now going into next year. I think the Democrats next year in the midterms attempt to make Donald Trump the issue and the focus of the campaign, I think that will be to their detriment. I was following that race since late summer, and I watched the Youngkin numbers get better and better. The gap at one point, Terry McAuliffe had a double-digit lead. Everybody had kind of written off Youngkin, and then it started to close. And McAuliffe ran a terrible campaign. First of all, as I said, using Trump as the centerpiece, but he just totally missed the mood of the public with this education issue. You know, it's all Democrats have always been favored by the public over Republicans for how to handle education. That changed on election night because of this radical critical race theory being injected into the schools, and because of the lockdowns and closing schools and not wanting to reopen schools, education became an issue. And it was Youngkin who was speaking to parents about the need to open schools again, and more, and just as importantly, the need to get this toxic ideology of critical race theory out of our schools. And McAuliffe totally misread that. He had Obama in, who called it a false outrage. We're just drumming up culture wars. That was not the mood of people in Democrat counties like Fairfax and Loudoun County that were taking to the streets and going to board meetings, school board meetings, demanding that these things be changed. And the Democrats totally misread it, primarily because the Democrats are really beholden to teachers unions. And we know teachers unions were not anxious to open up schools again, and we know that teachers unions support critical race theory. And so they misread it. They went to the support of the teachers unions at the expense of parents, and they paid a big, big price for it. And I think it sets forward, going forward, Republicans, if they're smart, can become the party of parents, and they can take these issues and run with them, certainly in 2022 and most likely again in 2024.
And Glenn Youngkin also did not use former President Trump, did not have him campaign in Virginia. Do you think strategically that could be used in certain districts in 2022 for midterms?
Of not using Trump?
Of not using Trump, yeah.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. You know, there may be some districts in this country, congressional districts, where Trump will be a big help to a Republican candidate. And there's going to be a lot of them, especially the swing districts, where he will be a detriment because you don't need, I believe next year, most Republicans are not going to need Donald Trump to fire up the base of Republican voters. The issues themselves are going to do that. And I've always said the one thing about Donald Trump, nothing can unite the Democrat Party quicker than Donald Trump on the ballot or in the public eye. And nothing puts fire in their eyes to get out and vote than Donald Trump. So Youngkin was smart not to bring him in, to leave him at arm's distance. And he wasn't disrespectful to Trump. He didn't disavow Trump. He just kept his distance strategically. That was very smart. And I think you're going to see a lot of Republicans running for Congress next year in swing districts do the same thing.
Now, I know, Carl, you know, I always ask you questions about something years in advance. But does that have any, do you think, does that tell anything about 2024, what happened in Virginia?
It certainly could. You know, right now, based on the polls, a majority of Republicans still want Donald Trump to be their candidate in 2024. I think that's got downsides. I just mentioned the two of them, uniting Democrats and putting fire in their eyes, fire in their ability to get out and vote and have a huge turnout. We're going to have to wait and see how that happens, what happens with that. We don't know what the field is yet, what other candidates are going to present themselves. We don't know what the issues are going to be. They may favor Trump. They may disfavor Trump. They may favor someone else and disfavor someone else. And it's not until you know you have all the ingredients of that stew that you know what the stew smells like and can taste like. So a lot of anticipation. We're going to have to wait and see. But, you know, politics is a funny business. And there may be somebody out there on the Republican side right now that's not even being considered a serious candidate who could emerge as such. So, you know, time will tell. But, Donald Trump will decide if he's going to run again, and then the party has to decide, is it in their best interest to nominate him and have him be the candidate and the titular head of the party, or is it time to move on and look for someone else?
Carl, we're going to talk about this with our next guest, Congressman Chris Jacobs. But finally, that infrastructure bill got through Congress. What do you think about it?
Well, I have mixed feelings about it. If I had been in Congress, I would have voted against it for a couple of reasons. First of all, it's really only a relatively small percentage of the money actually going to roads, bridges, and airports. But more importantly, you know, in that bill, there's a provision to establish a pilot program to test the idea of a mileage tax. And you might want to ask Chris if that actually ended up in the final bill. But it was in there for the longest time, and I assume it made it to the final cut. But that would be an interesting question to ask him. If it's in there, what it'll do is it'll have this two-year pilot program where they will test the idea of charging people a tax on their mileage that they drive. And then the results are going to go to the Department of Transportation to make a recommendation. Well, I think that was enough cover for any Republican to say, I'm not voting for it, because we know what happens with pilot programs. They become programs. And this is not the way we want to go, and this is not what our constituents want, and I'm off of this bill. So I was a little disappointed that so many Republicans went with it, especially if that provision made it to the final bill.
That was my next question. Were you surprised that any Republicans signed on with this? I believe 6 in total signed on with this bill.
No, I think it was actually 13.
13.
Was the final number. When you look at those numbers, of the 13, 6 came from New York and New Jersey, which stood to gain a lot of money for mass transit and road projects and things like that. So, you know, all politics being local, you can kind of understand the pressures they were under to represent their districts and their state. But like, as I said, I think any Republican could have used that mileage tax pilot program as cover to say, I'm just not voting for that.
And the final question, Carl, will be the same question I asked our last two guests, and that is, looking in Albany, looking toward next year, a primary, Kathy Hochul and Letitia James will both be in the primary. What do you think of that, and would that help a Lee Zeldin, who is also running for governor?
Well, I don't think the field is complete yet, Joe. I think de Blasio has announced he's going to be running, and Jumaane Williams has formed an exploratory committee. And Letitia James is already in. Those three Democrats, de Blasio, James, and Williams, all come from Brooklyn. That is the best scenario for Kathy Hochul, to have three people from the city, from one borough, dividing up that Democrat vote statewide and leaving her the more moderate upstate lane to win a primary in. So for Kathy Hochul, you got to say the more the merrier. She may have a problem on her right with Tom Suozzi, the congressman, who came to Buffalo, endorsed Byron Brown. Kathy Hochul stayed silent on that. He is staking himself out as the most moderate of all the fields. So he could be an issue. But right now, the more far-left New York City-based Democrats that get into that primary, the better it is for Kathy Hochul.
Carl Calabrese, always great talking to you. Thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Great. Thank you, Joe.
That is Carl Calabrese. You can hear him throughout the week here on WBEN and also on David Bellavia's show, which is also right here on WBEN. When we come back, yes, we'll be talking about that infrastructure bill and more with Congressman Chris Jacobs. It is Hardline on WBEN.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout.
15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
After the end of a good fight, you deserve an ice-cold reward. Medela, the mark of a fighter. You've earned this rich golden lager with a crisp, refreshing taste. Because you know, the bigger the fight, the better the reward. You put in the hours, the energy, the tough labor. You are a fighter, and Medela is your reward. Medela, the mark of a fighter. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
That's right. We'll be back here tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. for BMAZ and Beamer. But right now, it is Hardline here on News Radio 930 WBEN. And our guest on this Bills game day is Congressman Chris Jacobs. Congressman, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Congressman, to kick things off, what did you take away from some of the local elections here in New York State and around the United States on Tuesday?
Well, I was down in Washington this week, so certainly I was watching the local news, and a lot that was on there was the win in Virginia, which was pretty amazing. Virginia's fully a blue state. It's changed a lot over the years, and a resounding win from the Republican candidate there, and then also right down the line, the first African American lieutenant governor, who's Republican, and a first I think Hispanic American who's the attorney general, all Republicans, and I believe they did get their legislative, the House of Delegates, they call it, back Republican. So it was a wave in Virginia. Certainly, it was amazing to see how close the New Jersey gubernatorial race was. That is an incredibly blue state. So that was another one that, went late in the night, early in the morning to find out who actually won that. And then, of course, down back home, what we saw with Mayor Brown winning, is very rare to have a write-in situation like that and the mayor to win. I think the win of John Garcia for sheriff was really an incredible win. He had a lot of hurdles to overcome. With not having the conservative line and someone on that line, and then also another minor party candidate, and then the unprecedented turnout from the mayor race, and he was able to overcome all that. And I'm thrilled for him. I think he is going to be an outstanding sheriff.
Congressman, you mentioned the Virginia election, which is where a lot of the nation's eyes were. Were you surprised to see Speaker Pelosi right after that talk about the urgency for Democrats to spend more?
Yeah, it really was incredible, the tone deafness that I thought. I thought that I would see on Wednesday a real change in tone there. And it really is a sign that when you stay in that Washington bubble too long, you really lose a sense of reality. I mean, the thought that what I heard Speaker Pelosi and AOC say, well, the problem was the reason that we lost in Virginia was because we just didn't spend enough. And I don't think anybody in Virginia was saying that. They wanted sanity back in their politics. They didn't want to see their kids used as political pawns with what we've seen in the politics going on. And I think that is personally, for somebody that's been very involved in education for nearly 30 years, I believe education is right now at the forefront. Parents matter. Parents have a right to say, they always should, in the education of their children. Certainly the candidate in in Virginia, a Democratic governor candidate, you know, it had a brief moment of honesty in a debate. One said, you know, I don't think parents should have a say in the curriculum of their children or something along those lines. And that was, I think, the beginning of his end. But I think we have as Republicans now the opportunity to really take the reins in terms of education policy. And I hope we go towards the empowerment of parents, the empowerment of families, school choice, and what we've talked about, what I've talked about for a long time. I think this is a real opportunity. And the greatest thing here is that parents are engaged. They're at the school board level. They are not going to take this nonsense anymore. I think the arrogance that we've seen, that parents are not terrorists. Parents care about their kids, and they have every right to do so.
Speaking of nonsense, Congressman, we did have the infrastructure bill pass on Friday. What should we here in Western New York know about this bill that just passed Congress?
I think that, you know, certainly we have infrastructure needs here, and I've talked a lot about infrastructure, as many others are. And, you know, let me say, I was in August when this legislation was announced, or a framework, an agreement between Joe Biden and a bipartisan group of Democrats, bipartisan group of senators, rather, said they had an agreement, a framework agreement on infrastructure. I was thrilled. I was thrilled because they said it was going to be true infrastructure, that it was going to be all paid for, that there would be no additional monies loaded onto our national debt. And then quickly, as I looked into this, I saw that only 25% of what had been proposed was going to go to road and bridge construction, major project construction, which I think most people think of infrastructure. But also that quickly we found out that their paid for was really not. It was a lot of gimmicks. And the Congressional Budget Office, which scores things, came out and said, no, it's not fully paid for, far from it, and it's going to load another $400 billion, with a B, onto our deficit or our debt. And our debt is at the highest level it has ever been in our nation's history right now. So those are two things I was very, very concerned about, and gave me a lot of pause. But really, the terrible thing here is almost right after the agreement was made that Biden walked out with the senators, another meeting came, a press conference with Pelosi and Biden, and they said, well, we have an agreement on this infrastructure bill, but only if we also pass the $3.5 trillion reconciliation, the socialist wish list legislation, which AOC and Bernie Sanders had been touting. So they really, at that point in time, said we are holding infrastructure hostage, and it's only going to be passed, basically making it one big bill. And that's really what happened. It's been back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And now we're talking about they passed the rule, the first out of for the reconciliation out of Congress in the middle of the 1 a.m, the largest expenditure ever in the history of our nation was passed at 1 a.m, so people couldn't see it. And now that's going back to the Senate. And so, you know, and this is going to dramatically increase the taxes, the spending, the major expenditure of government into our lives. And as Joe Manchin has mentioned, the concern is we're going to have all these new entitlements, all these obligations that we're going to do all these things for people, yet both Social Security and Medicare are on the cusp of being bankrupt. So, you know, we're really heading down a very alarming path. That's why I, you know, was a no vote on this. Certainly, I believe we need to have a real discussion on infrastructure. But this major expansion of government into our lives and just dramatically increasing the debt that we have that I do not believe is sustainable. I think we're heading towards a kind of a bankruptcy at some point in time where we just can't. This is about not me and not you. It's about our children and our grandchildren who are going to be saddled with this debt for generations to come. We will have a country that will not be able to compete like we should, to do the things we should, and to defend ourselves like we should. So that was my concern. And that's why where I was on my vote.
Now, this question's from our last guest, Carl Calabrese. He was wondering, is the mileage tax study still a part of the bill that passed?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. The mileage tax study is. So there's a lot of questions on that, and how intrusive that will be. There's a lot of social engineering, if you will, and a lot in both these bills, and a lot of things they want to do that I think people, as they become aware of it, will be more concerned as time goes on.
Now, another thing that happened this week, Congressman, was you co-sponsoring the legislation to prevent payments to illegal immigrants. And it seems like we're getting a lot of mixed messages from the White House in what this actually is. What is the payments to illegal immigrants, and what was the bill that you co-sponsored?
Yeah, and I will say, too, in the infrastructure bill, there's hardly anything on securing the southern border. And then, of course, the reconciliation bill, the $3.5 trillion wish list, or, you know, might go down to 1.73 or 2 trillion or whatever, because they keep playing with the numbers. But it's the amnesty for millions, and also no securing of the southern border, which is continued to be a crisis. Yeah, I think we were all shocked when we heard this, that there was settlement negotiations between the administration and those individuals that entered this country illegally, settling because of the situation that they had brought themselves into by illegal entering the country. And the settlements were going to average out about $450,000 per person. And so we've spoken up on that, and I'm sure you're aware that when he was first asked, the president said, no way, we wouldn't do something like that. And then the ACLU, which is party to the settlement, said, President Biden better talk to his Department of Justice, because we are in negotiation. So they are doing this. I've introduced legislation to prevent it. This is far more than a family would get if their loved one died in battle. So we're going to pay those that entered the country illegally $450,000, and a hero who fought on behalf of our nation, their family would get far, far less. So this is wrong in so many ways. It's also wrong because it's going to incentivize. It's frustrating that we don't learn, or the administration doesn't seem to learn, that the drug cartels that deal with the illegal migration coming up from the southern border respond to our bad policy. So if we start offering $400,000 settlements for family situations that have come here, don't you think they're going to drive more so they get that settlement? Of course they are. That's what they've been doing. This is all about money. So this is also bad because it will cause more human suffering of individuals coming and being used coming across the border.
On the legislation you co-sponsored, has there been any members of the other side of the aisle that are interested in joining into this, or is it strictly party lines?
I would have to check that. My understanding at this point in time is we do not have any Democratic co-sponsors. I would think that the only place I would hope is that we've seen some Democrats in Texas speak up on the southern border issue, because it's so profound in terms of how it's impacting their communities. So that's where I would see it, but I don't think I have seen it at this point in time.
Congressman, we know you keep your eye on the southern border, and we've heard not only of people continuing to come over the southern border, but also of flights by the administration into New York State. What can you tell us about those two things?
Yeah, I've also partied to correspondents trying to get some more information about these kind of covert flights bringing illegal immigrants into the interior of the United States, which we've known is happening, but now they're doing it secretly. And I know there was one that came into, I believe, Long Island area. So, again, this is they're saying one thing at the press conferences and then clearly doing other things to the country. And we need to continue to fight against this, and I intend to do so with every fiber I have. But also, we need to highlight the lying and the hypocrisy that we're seeing from this administration, and it's really getting to a heightened level. And I think more and more people are getting concerned about this. We're seeing at the polling that it's not only hardcore Republicans that have concerns with this administration now, but Joe Biden has lost the faith of nearly every independent and a lot of Democrats as well.
We also see the mandate for large employers getting challenged, not only in court, but by some members in Congress as well. Do you see that going through, or do you think that it's got enough power in D.C. to not become a law, the mandate on large employers for vaccination?
Well, I think the Biden administration is seen to ignore things. We've seen this on numerous occasions when they know full well they are overstepping their constitutional prerogative. They do it anyway. And so I think that our best hope here is what we're seeing in the courts. And I think that it was a real stretch. I think it is a real stretch where what we're seeing in the administration demanding or imposing the mandates on employers like Moog because they are contractors, the government contractors. And I think that is on very shaky constitutional ground. But when we're talking about purely private contractors to try to use OSHA to do that, I think that's on very shaky constitutional ground. So I'm frankly hopeful on this lawsuit. I'm glad they enacted the stay because the damage is significant. So they should have done that as they deliberate. But I think we have a very good constitutional legal position, and I'm thrilled that the court took its first step to stay this nonsense. Let's keep in mind, we've made major progress on COVID. The COVID rates are down dramatically. We need to continue to just educate people about their choice. But mandates and lockdowns are ineffective, I believe counterproductive. And I really wish, but I'm not optimistic that the administration decides to take a different tack.
Congressman, I apologize. I did not ask you about this when asking you to come on the show. So if you have no comment, I completely understand. But there's been a lot of talk about the Bill Stadium and this agreement to get a new Bill Stadium. Have you kept your eye on that? And where do you think a new Bill Stadium belongs?
I certainly have kept my eye on it. I'm not in privy to negotiations. That would be the county executive, the governor, and of course, the Bills. My main focus is that they remain here, that I do believe we need a new stadium, and that I believe it needs to be a partnership and with fairness on both sides. But I just think we are so lucky to have the Bills here, to have a good ownership team, ownership in the Pegulas. I mean, let's keep in mind, it wasn't that long ago when Ralph Wilson had passed away that we were so, so concerned that they would get sold, and because of the capital gains or estate tax impact, that there was no way they could stay here. And so we're in a much, much better place. Of course, our team's a lot better, too. But I'm really focused, and I've certainly conveyed to all the parties, I'm ready and willing to help to make sure that the deal can happen, and I will leave the decision where to the other parties. But this is a regional team, and the most important thing is they're here, and they're here to stay for the long term.
Well, Congressman, with an hour till kickoff, I'll let you go. I thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Okay, thanks so much.
That is Congressman Chris Jacobs joining us. And that is Hardline for November 7th, 2021. We'll be back here next week. The Bills play in an hour and 5 minutes, of course. Go Bills. Let's hope. I've had a bad sports weekend, so let's hope the Bills can turn that around in Jacksonville today. Hey, we'll be back here tomorrow with our award-winning lineup on WBEN, starting with A New Morning with Susan Rose and Brian Mazurowski, B-Maz and Beamer, David Bellavia, 10 to 2, Tom Bowerly, 2 to 6, and Buffalo's Evening News with Tom Puckett to wrap up your day. Have a great Sunday. Go Bills. We'll talk to you tomorrow here on WBEN.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well-qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app, the biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.